Hello, Pacific Palisades. Welcome to the November edition of the Pali Podcast, where we bring together someone or some people hyper interesting from the community, and we have an hour-long conversation with them the same way you might do if you were to bump into them at a cocktail party right here in the Palisades. So happy to join you guys again in November. Here I am with my co-host, Steve Crone. How are you doing, Mr. Crone?
Great. Glad to be back here at Village Studios, as always. Got a special, this is, I think, the first time that I recall we've had two guests at the same time.
It is not. Our first time having two guests, Steve, was Allison and Nick Melvoin, where
you
they
are right.
Broke actually huge news for us here, right here at the Pali Podcast.
That's true, but that was virtual, so
true.
I wasn't actually looking at two people today. We were in the studio with Tom Weitzel and Jeremy Lewerse. Tom is my neighbor. He lives about 100 feet from me. So if he doesn't like this broadcast, he can just yell real loud and tell me about it. Tom and Jeremy, you've written a book, The Beatles in Los Angeles, and we want to hear all about it. But before we do that, I'd like to have each of you tell us a little bit about your background in entertainment, publishing, writing, producing, and then the big question, you can figure out who gets to answer it. What made you guys do this book? Take it away, anyone who wants.
I'll start. I'm actually second generation as far as being in media. My dad was a radio disc jockey. He started it in the big band era.
I might add, this is Tom Weitzel.
And thank you. And as such, at the end of 1963, as a DJ, he brought home to me an album by this group, Meet the Beatles. The Beatles had not been seen anywhere else. So that's where I started my interest in the Beatles. Following in my father's footsteps, I would eventually get a master's degree in television from Syracuse University, which really meant nothing when I started in the business because I started as a gopher at the Mike Douglas Show about a month after John and Yoko had finished their very, very famous stint as co-hosts. From there, I've been in entertainment-related television basically all my life, spending 26 years at Entertainment Tonight, and have done television on six of the seven continents. And as I point out in the introduction, I've met four presidents and two Beatles, and I've always wished it was the other way around.
Jeremy, how about you?
Well, my first big break in media was actually here in Los Angeles. I was working for a program that's still on the air called Inside Edition. And I had just graduated New York University, and they sent me out here to cover the O.J. Simpson trial. So that led to a year and a half of my life being downtown at the courthouse and having all sorts of adventures. It sort of started when I gave my card to Robert Shapiro, and he started giving me some information that I could use on the air. And then from there, I sort of followed the path that Tom did and went into the syndicated entertainment world, worked for Access Hollywood for quite some time, and then eventually Entertainment Tonight with Tom. And we actually sat right next to each other.
Sat next to each other, yeah.
Yeah. And formed a relationship, and when it came time to write the Beatles in Los Angeles, he was the first guy I called.
So when you say came time, was this an epiphany, or was there some event, or what made you decide?
I would call it an epiphany. I had realized that there were a number of things that happened to the Beatles in Los Angeles, a number of them. And I started making a list with the idea of maybe a documentary in mind, and realized that a documentary wasn't going to work. There's too many people that aren't living anymore. The music would be a problem. And so started exploring maybe writing a book. And Tom and I met at the Palm in Beverly Hills, and I sat down, and I had a list of about 10 stories that the Beatles had experienced in Los Angeles, and Tom looked at it and said, okay, let's start chipping away.
It's like the old Jerry Maguire, you had me at hello. You know? It was like, of course I would do it. You know, any excuse to work with Jeremy, who I sat next to for so many years, and to find out more about my favorite group easily. That was just, it just made perfect sense. And the thing about Jeremy and I is that doing the work that we do and have done is we're no-nonsense kind of guys. I mean, we had to deliver television on a tremendous deadline on a daily basis. So we don't stand much on ceremony, and we can really get to the heart of the matter pretty quickly. So I knew it would be a great working relationship, and it has been, and it will continue to be.
One follow-up question, and then it's yours, Mira. Those items, those 10 or 12 things, were those, did you find them on the internet? How did they come to you? How do you know that those things were real?
Well, I had grown up a massive Beatles fan, and through the years I've, you know, read books or read articles. You know, when I was a little kid, my mom used to play the Yellow Submarine VHS for me. That was my entertainment. But they came from various, to answer your question, they came from various outlets. But there was a lot, it was important to hook up with Tom because I knew him and I could expand on those stories and uncover things that had never been heard before as well. And so it became very important to get a hold of the people that were there. That was our main goal when we sat down originally. We said, this has got to be new, fresh material that people have never heard before. And the only way we're going to get that is to use the interview skills that we've learned over the years and track down the people that were there.
So that's what I was going to ask. I was going to say that those 10 stories that you came across would have had to be stories that you knew stemmed from L.A., somewhere in L.A., an L.A. experience. They would have had to involve people in L.A. And I'm assuming that from those people, you got more and more and more stories and kind of fanned out from there. The reason it's so interesting to me is because just a couple of days ago, I read an article that someone had written about someone who's in the media right now, embroiled in something, some controversy. And this was a friend from many years ago. And so she sat down and she wrote this article from the point of view of herself, a friend from decades ago, who also knew other people who know this person along the way. And the story, and it's a long article, but the story she weaves is something entirely different than what you get sort of in the mass media with like just facts. And I feel like that's what you guys got. You got this behind the scenes, crazy stories, iconic spots, you know, these, you know, great tales of four or five people that really occupy a great place in the American psyche. So how fast did that grow? You went from those 10 stories, maybe you hooked up with two people, and then how fast did that grow?
I think that, and Tom, you know, feel free to
sure.
jump in, but I think that the best example of what you're talking about is the story about Elvis, which is Chapter 5. This is where, you know, Bel Air is where the Beatles met Elvis for the only time. Everybody kind of knows that story. Everybody has dissected what happened in those walls.
But as we point out, everybody remembers it a different way.
Everybody remembers it a different way. But what we discovered were photos of that night. And there were supposedly never photos taken, ever.
It was part of the ground rules.
Yeah, part of the ground rules. You couldn't take photos. You weren't...
For the Beatles?
Both of them.
Both of them.
They
agreed.
Wanted it to be a very private meeting.
The lads basically said that if it's going to be a press event, we're not going.
Right. So what we did was not only did we uncover the photos, but we tell the story of how those photos were almost lost forever. That record of the Beatles and Elvis together on the driveway in Bel Air, they almost disappeared. And we tell the story of how they were uncovered. And that was the spirit of the book, to uncover a different angle on stories that may be well known.
Yeah, the way I think the way that we approached it is that at this stage, there are very few things about the Beatles that are unreported, but some things are still underreported. And again, coming from the background that Jeremy and I come from, we know how to get to eyewitnesses. And sometimes the best eyewitnesses are not the most famous person in the room. And yet they are still quite valid sources. I think of Karen Grassley, who was not exactly an unknown, but I mean, she was the one of the stars of Little House on the Prairie. And she was the co-host at the John Davidson show when Ringo and Barbara Bach made an appearance on the John, which was then at the time a relatively new talk show, the John Davidson show. And Karen really hadn't been interviewed about that event. And so I interviewed her and
uncovered some incredible stories about that talk show appearance is very famous because of how high Ringo and Barbara were. And it turned into sort of a disaster. And Karen gave us the behind the scenes on how that all unfolded and how Ringo handled it and how John Davidson handled it. And again, this is all something that happened in Hollywood on a stage in the 1970s.
And were people like Karen, for example, were they eager to talk, or did you have to convince them to be a part of it? I'm wondering whether people wanted to dredge up those memories, or they were reluctant and you had to keep pushing. How did that go? Or maybe you can't paint everybody with the same brush.
The thing to remember is that everybody we spoke to had exceptionally vivid memories. You meet a Beatle or the Beatles, you remember everything about that day. So there's that. Secondly, we were not going for sleaze. We're not looking for stories about groupies or, days of excess. Although there is a bit of bad boy behavior in the book. There's no doubt. So we weren't dredging up unpleasant things. So it was a great chance to relive interesting and often fun times. And so generally, if we could get to people and ask them, the answer was yes.
It's a happy book. It's meant to cheer people up, and these stories are inspiring. But to answer your question, I think the biggest challenge was getting people to talk to us. We'd never written a book before.
So, there is that.
So you have nothing to point to. You can't say, hey, I wrote this and, I'm an experienced author. You had to find people that were willing to kind of roll the dice with you.
Tell a story.
Yeah.
Yeah, help you tell a story.
And, the one person that comes to mind is Elliot Mintz, who was John Lennon's longtime publicist. He gave us a very nice interview, but he's nocturnal. And so, he told me, hey, I'll do this interview, but let's do it at midnight. And, midnight, I'm sorry, I'm not awake usually at midnight. So, I sat in my backyard, trying not to wake up my kids, my wife and kids for 2 hours.
Wow.
Talking to him, on the phone. And, it was stuff like that made you had to keep with it. If you wanted to have Elliot Mintz be a part of this book, you had to do the interview when he wanted to do it.
Interesting. One of the early stories you tell was crazy interesting. And again, this idea that you're really going behind the scenes and you're showing a perspective that isn't often seen. I mean, who knew that someone had to mortgage their house for the Beatles to be able to play for the first time at the Hollywood Bowl? And it's this unassuming little house in the valley.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that. I couldn't believe that the Beatles story starts in Woodland Hills and really at the corner of Topanga and Ventura, which
with
is
a willing bank.
With a little bank and the that house and the guy who mortgages it happens to be Bob Eubanks. But I'll just kind of leave the story there. And
for people to read.
For people to read.
Yeah.
But we can share that it was just a full circle moment when a couple of months ago, Jeremy and I opened up a bank account for this project. And we opened it up down the street from where the bank was that gave Bob Eubanks the loan.
Well, I know where you live. Why would you be going out to Woodland Hills to open a...
That's where I live now.
And
that's actually how we found the house.
Yeah.
That was a new bit of information that people probably don't know.
But it was part of the meant to be for the book, Steve. He had to get out of the Palisades to make this
You don't want to share any more about the story? We'll
no, I mean, I'm happy.
Teaser. It's up to you.
Yeah, no.
We'll leave it as a teaser.
Eventually, you know, Bob Eubanks mortgaged his house because he needed to pay for the Beatles to perform at the Hollywood Bowl.
The ungodly sum of $25,000.
Which was also mind-boggling. Yeah.
Right. Now, admittedly, it was 1964, so that is probably $80,000, $100,000 in today's dollars.
And it comes up only about $4,000 or $5,000 positive from that experience. Just crazy to think about perspective and how life evolves. Talking about a total sum of $30,000.
He was a DJ, right?
Yeah, at the time he was a DJ.
Yeah.
I remember.
But also think of that time. It was the days of the one-hit wonders. I mean, you know, these guys could have been four Fabians or four Dions or, you know, who knew? Who knew? I mean, it's only in retrospect that their tremendous gifts have become appreciated and beloved.
And Bob was the only one that was going to take a risk on him because normally, I guess, you paid a performer $15,000. If Frank Sinatra wanted to play the Hollywood Bowl at the time, he cost $15,000. So everyone said, I'm not going to pay $25,000. Are you kidding me? That's ridiculous. And Bob was the one that took the risk.
Is there any parallel with your book coming out now, and there's a new documentary coming out on Disney Plus that I've been hearing about the Beatles, like a three-part. Is that just total coincidence?
It's not a total coincidence. In the we've worked in television all of our lives. We know the value of getting product out in the world when people are talking about it, when people are most interested in it. So we have known about this documentary. It's actually a re-edit of 60 hours of film that was shot. And so we've known about it for a long time. So we've done everything we can to be part of what I predict will be a new wave of Beatlemania.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Here we are again, Steve, on the cusp of some breaking news right here at the Pally Podcast.
We always are, Miriam. You know that.
It's you and me. Tom, you've said that you have met two Beatles and four presidents, and you wish it was the other way around. Tell us a little bit about, the Beatles you met and then your four presidents.
Well, the two Beatles are Paul and Ringo. And I'm working at Entertainment Tonight. You do short interviews sometimes. The Ringo interview is probably a 15-minute interview. The McCartney interview is all of about 2 minutes on an arrival line, quite a truth be told. But the fact is I did meet him. And at the time, he was married to Heather Mills. And after I asked him the obligatory question, why is it important for you to be here? He was performing for a charity event. I decided to ask his then-wife, Heather Mills. I asked her if he ever sang around the house. And she kind of looked at me and said, oh, you know, he should more, you know, was her response. So,
and right then you knew the marriage wasn't going to last.
I won't go there. The four presidents are President Reagan with his lovely wife, Nancy, Jimmy Carter, who I think is just a living example of how we can live our lives. Bill Clinton. And it's
another
true.
Example of how we can live our lives.
if you can get away with it. And then I met Mr. Trump at Mar-a-Lago when he was marrying Melania.
So you met, first of all, I want to say, I think you have, if I'm not mistaken, I think you have something in the book about when Paul meets Heather Mills or boots off someone else for Heather Mills, right?
No. It's actually, at that point, he's booting off Peggy Lipton for Linda Eastman.
Ah.
So.
And that all happened at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Yes, it did. Yes. It's such an interesting little piece.
Yeah.
It's funny that lives intertwine. I mean, you probably could have interviewed people for years to come. But, okay, so at what point in his career did you meet Jimmy Carter?
He was retired and living in Plains, Georgia. He had started his work for Habitat for Humanity. And we wanted to talk to him about life after the presidency. Believe it or not, that was an Entertainment Tonight segment. And I flew with a very well-known Los Angeles-based journalist, Jan Carl. We flew into Atlanta and then drove to Plains, Georgia, and interviewed the former president. The rule that we were told is that you have Mr. Carter for half an hour. And sure enough, I mean, Jimmy Carter, a former Navy man, has an internal clock that is second to none. We sat down, clipped a microphone on him, and I swear, in the middle of a sentence, half an hour was done, he unclipped the microphone and said, "Thank you very much, guys."
And, really?
And was out the door. I mean, it was polite as right. the day is long, but if you have half an hour with Jimmy Carter, you do not have 31 minutes with Jimmy Carter.
So I have to ask, was it soon after his presidency or was it a little bit later?
Because it was several years past.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But early in the Habitat for Humanity thing?
Yes, yeah.
So did he sound content? I mean, was this a content man you were talking to or was he – I mean, I assume, for everything I've read, they kind of – that team walked out of the White House with some baggage. Even if you haven't read anything, you know anything
right.
about politics, you know that team walked out of the White House with some baggage. By the time you met him, was he – you know, had he shed some of it? Did he sound content looking ahead?
He seemed extremely content and focused. And I think that a combination of his military background and his religious faith gives him, I think, to this day, a centering that is quite frankly enviable. And there was a humility about him that struck me. I mean, he was he was present. He was present.
When I think back on him, I think of him as a really good man, a guy with a good inner compass, who kind of got caught up in some situations that were maybe beyond his control, like the Iranian hostage crisis, which, you know, he couldn't do anything about it. He tried. Then he got into inflationary problems, which we're starting to see nowadays in our current economy. And he got defeated, but I still think of him as a guy that had maybe more principles than any president in my lifetime.
I could not agree
you know,
with
that
you.
He did what he thought was right. He wasn't doing it for political reasons. And maybe if he had been a little shrewder politically, he might have lasted longer, come out of this looking better in the history books. But I have the feeling he did what he thought was right. And that was what was his compass.
I couldn't agree with you more.
So interesting that you credit him. You credit him with some humility. How was humility when you met Ronald Reagan?
My wife Nancy and I were at the taping of a special an NBC special. It was called The All-Star Party for Dutch Reagan. My wife is a journalist, and she at that time was writing television stories, so we were invited to be part of this event. We shared a table with Lonnie Anderson and some other names of the mid-'80s. And following the special, the president and Mrs. Reagan stood at a reception line, and he was charming, as just a charming man. And I said, "Mr. President, Mrs. Reagan, I'd like to introduce you to my Nancy." And he said, "Oh, that's cool, yeah." That he really did talk like Dana Carvey, truth be told. Again, just Jeremy and I, in dealing with celebrities, know when people are present or are going through the motions. And again, Reagan, present, even at that social moment.
Yeah.
So that was a good impression.
Yeah, it was. It really was. It's interesting that Carter was humble and Reagan was charismatic, you said? No.
I would say that Clinton was charismatic. Reagan was sincere.
Uh-huh. That's how you think of them. Reagan, I feel like the stereotypes you have of these big people who are in the news all the time somewhat turn out to be true when you actually meet them. And as you say, like when you met Clinton, he really did feel like he was focused in on you. It's interesting to think that these are really true.
I want to go back to another aspect of how this book got started. So, Jeremy, you talked about your list, 10, 12 things that got you started on this. Were there, when in doing your research, both you and Tom, were there things that you found about those 10, 12, whatever number there were, items that proved not to be true or that were so, the reality was so different than what you thought as to completely change your opinion about that experience or that event?
I felt that there was a lack of detail in some of the research we did. We found the stories, but there was a real lack of detail on what exactly happened and how it all came together and that kind of thing. We did find a couple of untruths. One is there was a famous appearance of John Lennon on Monday Night Football with Howard Cosell that took place at the Los Angeles Coliseum. And everybody thought that that appearance came together because John had run into Frank Gifford, the other host on Monday Night Football, in a hotel earlier that day. And that was not the case at all. If you dug deep, you realize, and we tell the story in the book, that this was a highly orchestrated publicity event between Howard, John, and a record executive named Bruce Wendell, who was a big Capitol Records executive in the 70s and took the Beatles to all their appearances. And so to answer your question, yeah, there was some information out there that was not true, and the book sets the record straight on some of that.
And let's remind people who John Lennon shared that Monday Night Football booth with. Ronald Reagan. So the Gipper had his arm around John.
Yeah, so they were both scheduled to be halftime guests, and there was actually sort of a conversation between Frank Gifford and Cosell about who would interview whom. And when I talked to Frank Gifford about it several years ago when I worked for ESPN, we quote him in the book, and Frank says that Cosell was adamant about interviewing John, and he said, you know, "I'll take the Beatle, you take the governor." And so, yeah, there it comes full circle.
Very nice.
That sounds like Howard Cosell wanting to get the top dog.
Yeah, wanted to interview the Beatle, and they had done a radio interview actually a couple months earlier in New York, so they kind of knew each other. And then, of course, the story unfortunately takes a tragic turn with Howard actually announcing the death of John Lennon on Monday Night Football just a few years later in 1980.
Yeah, it was 19, yeah.
Yeah.
The timing worked out that way? John Lennon was shot?
John Lennon was shot
on a Monday night.
Yeah, shot on a Monday night. And we tell the story of how ABC News got word, and they had called the truck, the ABC sports truck, and told them that they wanted...
They had to break in with breaking news,
and that was a very big moment for Howard Cosell. Yeah.
A big moment
in his career.
A big moment is
everything.
Career.
Everything.
Why? Because he was the guy that
he was the guy that had to make the announcement. He knew John, and he wasn't used to that kind of journalism. He's talking about touchdowns and boxing matches, and to have to all of a sudden make this horrible, tragic announcement.
Almost like...
About someone that he knows.
Yeah.
Almost like Walter Cronkite making the announcement about John Kennedy being assassinated.
Yes.
Which is seared in my brain forever watching that.
Yeah. You see him take his glasses off and...
Right.
This moment is very similar. And you'll see on anniversaries of John Lennon's death, the sports world will talk about this moment and play the moment. And... you know, it's the one real time where the NFL and sports and the Beatles intertwined.
I don't remember it, but I assume Howard handled it well.
He handled it beautifully. He really did. It's about 30 seconds, and you can look it up on YouTube. There's 3 seconds left
in
the game.
On the clock. Yeah.
And, you know, another story that we tell is about a player that was on the field that night. And, you know, when an NFL player scores a touchdown, that's the most euphoric moment that they can have. And there was a gentleman named Russ Francis, who Patriots were playing the Dolphins in that game. He was a tight end for the Patriots, scored a touchdown, feeling this tremendous euphoria, went over to the sideline to get some water after he had scored, and news had started spreading through the stands, through local radio stations, and people were hearing it on their local radio. And he remembers hearing in the stands someone saying, John Lennon has been shot. John Lennon is dead. And so he has this euphoria of scoring a touchdown and then learning that one of his heroes is gone. And he explains what that emotion is like.
Wow, and that's in the book.
Oh, yeah.
How beautiful. I'm going to look for that. Yeah, that must have been
one of the great things about
one man.
One of the great things about working with Jeremy is that Jeremy currently works at the NFL Network, has a tremendous background in sports. I have no background in sports. And it's interesting that people who cover sports understand the power of icons, and that's what the Beatles are, individually and as a group. And so, again, with our celebrity journalism background, we understand the power that these people have over people's imaginations, over their lives, over the way they live their lives.
Yeah. So I have to ask you about Michael Jackson. There's something in the book about how that intersects, the Paul McCartney-Michael Jackson collab with a local producer. How did that story evolve?
Yeah, I mean, it all goes back to Peggy Lipton again.
Exactly, yeah.
So
married the producer, right?
Yes.
Well, yeah. For people who are listening, Peggy Lipton, at one point as a teenage journalist, interviews Paul McCartney for Teen Screen, a movie magazine, 18 years old, and later is the woman who was jilted by Paul McCartney for Linda Eastman, who would become his wife. Peggy Lipton would eventually marry Quincy Jones.
Yeah, and then Quincy Jones would produce Michael and Paul on ironically, the song "The Girl Is Mine."
Yeah, right. Yeah.
The girl is not his at all. Yeah.
But Michael Jackson, again, is one of those characters. A, L.A., right? L.A.
Right.
based. I think when he died, he was right here in Bel Air.
Yes.
And then, you know, another icon, another one of these people you're talking about that elicits great emotion and reaction in people. And the fact that these two came together right here in this town.
Yeah. And that they met here.
Yeah.
And that they went to parties here in the 70s and were very specific about which parties those were.
Really?
And where they met and what they talked about and how they first started to collaborate. But it all did. It all started here.
L.A. is a very small town in some respects.
So we've talked a lot about the Beatles, but one of the things I know you write about in your book is a kind of mini reunion between Paul and Ringo at, was it a Dodger Stadium?
Dodger Stadium.
Yeah. How did that come about? And had they been estranged? I mean, they were the only two. They're still the only two surviving Beatles. But
yeah, no, they weren't estranged. It's just there's always with the Beatles, and it seems to be a theme throughout this book. Everybody always asks them when they're going to reunite. That's the question that is constantly there.
Still.
Still.
With two of them.
Even with just two of them.
I know. It's the, yeah.
It's which is
defies,
crazy. So, you know.
Defies imagination.
When Ringo and Paul, obviously the only two, you know, they're alive, when they team up, that's a very special event. That's a big deal. And it hasn't happened that much. And
you point out two in the book.
Yeah, there's two times it happened in Los Angeles. Once was at a special celebrating the 50th anniversary of their appearance on Ed Sullivan. And that happened at the Los Angeles Convention Center. But literally the last time Paul performed live because of the pandemic was at Dodger Stadium. And I happened to be at that show.
That was 2019.
2019. And I would imagine that people listening to this podcast were probably there too. But they're, you know, it's always incredible to see Paul McCartney in concert. And, you know, you find yourself in tears sometimes. But towards the end of that show, when Ringo came on and sang Helter Skelter of all things, like minutes.
Or, in L.A.
Yeah, in L.A. And it was literally days before Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was coming out, which was kind of weird, too, because the whole town was kind of, you know, looking forward to that movie. And obviously it's about the Manson murders. And then for them to sing Helter Skelter and for people to see that, it was an amazing, amazing moment at Dodger Stadium. And, you know, the thing I noticed about being at that concert is you had, you know, kids that were 7 years old and you had people that were 80 years old, and it was just a whole generational thing, which was so cool. But a 20-something year old that happened to be sitting next to me actually asked the question, does Ringo always show up?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we had to sort of set the record straight on that one. But it was it really was the last time Paul performed live. And, you know, hopefully we'll see him again on a stage. But
if I may, though, Jeremy, yeah. You had the pleasure of being at the secret, what was billed as a secret concert here in Los Angeles, right on the Sunset Strip at Amoeba Records, where Ringo and Barbara were in the audience, at least, and Olivia Harrison, George's widow, was there as well. And we talked to the people of Amoeba Records about how that concert came about, what it was like. And and one of the most remarkable things is that at the stage that Paul McCartney has been at for the last 30 years, 40, 50 years, he could have come on and sung two songs and the crowd would have been entirely satisfied. But no, he played for 90 minutes, and one of the most emotional moments, which Jeremy, you actually witnessed. Jeremy was there on the spot, and
Yeah, there was a moment, you know, with Ringo in the crowd and everybody. I mean, there was 900 people at this show. With Ringo in the crowd, you thought, okay, this is it. They're gonna you know, rock and roll together here. And there was a moment at the very end of the show, right before they did the last song, where Paul McCartney's current drummer, his name's Abe, stood up and
offered the sticks.
And Ringo sort of shook his head no. Oh. And then they I think they sang Twist and Shout after that. But
so Ringo sang, but he didn't play.
No, Ringo
no, he
didn't.
Just stayed in the audience.
He just said, "It's not my time."
No, yeah.
So, for us to get that payoff in 2019 was nice.
And not to give too much away, but there was a rather emotional moment early on in that Amoeba concert. That quite frankly, again, I wasn't there, and Jeremy and I would share manuscript pages back and forth. And when I read it, my first thought, "Oh, to be there."
Yeah.
Tell us about that emotional moment. Yeah.
It was when he was singing a song about John Lennon.
Aww.
And he actually teared up. And we knew we were seeing something special. I mean, it was already, people had waited on the sidewalk, slept overnight for 2 days. You know, they didn't want to announce it too far ahead of time. They literally announced it 2 days before. And it was amazing what the Amoeba staff went through to make all this happen, make sure that Paul was safe, to make sure that everybody who got there early enough got in. You know, it was a logistics.
Really a tribute to them.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting, given what's going on right now with a recent concert that turned into a tragedy. Totally different.
No.
Totally different audience, I think, a different time, a different kind of music, a different vibe.
When the Beatles split up, you know, there's all these stories about Yoko Ono dividing up the band and other things. And is my recollection, I'm not a student of the Beatles, but my recollection was that they split up and there was some bad feelings for a while. But it sounds to me like within a relatively reasonable period of time, that went away and they were able to be at least friendly afterwards.
Oh, absolutely.
And what you're describing is a guy maybe thinking back on his youth and the fond feelings they had for one another before things got bad.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a moment in 1974 on Malibu Beach where John talks about where the relationship is at that point, 1974. And he speaks very, very positively of his three friends. And I would say that's a pretty unknown tale.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. That he would show up. John Lennon did an interview on Surf Rider Beach, and no one was there.
Can you imagine?
The most famous man in the world walking, you know, the Malibu Pier, and there's no one there. He had what a rare opportunity to see this man in a natural element. A guy that couldn't go outside had the whole beach to himself.
And what was the first thing he wanted to do?
He wanted to drive a car.
That's right. He wanted to drive
off the pier,
which didn't go so well.
No. He wanted to drive Elliot Mintz's car, and
he's not a very good driver.
He seems like he was not a very good driver. No.
Well, he probably never had to drive. I mean, you know, when he's young, he probably. I mean, they became famous when they were so young, and then after that, he's driven everywhere and flown everywhere, and probably never had to learn that skill.
And funnily enough, became famous while walking across a crosswalk.
Yes, exactly.
True.
So all these places in L.A. that get mentioned in your book, you want to tell us a little bit about the gates and at Benedict Canyon?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Zsa Zsa
Gabor's house, it's now torn down. I think they're building something else there. But the gates are still there.
Yeah,
and the reason the gates are important is because nobody could get past those gates. And the people that did get past those gates were the Byrds and Peter Fonda. And they ended up
And a couple of Playboy bunnies.
A couple of Playboy
they
bunnies.
They were young men. They were young single men.
And maybe some other young single women that were behind the gates.
But they all...
Not our story.
Yeah. Anybody, there's a great story in another story here, though, with Peter Fonda.
Yeah. Anybody who did get through those gates got to witness and or actually participate in an acid trip with the Beatles. And it was a very... important acid trip in their lives because of the music that came out of that particular trip, and it all
which was the, what
she said,
which is the lead off track of Revolver. She said, I know what it's like to be dead,
and that all stemmed from Peter Fonda, which is a well known story in Beatle folklore. But again, it's glossed over that we get very detailed in that particular chapter on what exactly happened, where it happened, how it happened.
Who said what, yeah.
And there's also a wonderful story, I think, as part of that chapter, to show you the devotion and the lengths that Beatle fans would go to get closer to their idols. And a couple of teenage girls rented a helicopter and with the appropriate pilot to fly over the house. And again, what goes through the mind of a teenager somehow to wave and yell down at them.
I might also add a wealthy teenager.
$50 an hour it cost them.
50, yeah, it was, yes.
That's it?
That was
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it wasn't bad, yeah.
A guy named Russell O'Quinn, yeah. They rented it from, and one girl actually tried to jump in the pool and
Russell had to pull her back, yeah.
Wow, $50 an hour for a helicopter ride.
And it was one of these tiny little Beljet Rangers, so, you know, with the just it's like a bubble with a motor on it, and so they had to take turns because they couldn't fit all three girls in at the same time.
Nowadays, you just get a drone.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But we talked to a couple of the helicopter girls.
Yeah,
their memories were vivid.
And also we talked to a former Palisade, Grand Marshal of the Palisades July 4th parade, Pat Boone.
Pat Boone.
Pat Boone, yes.
Was he behind the gates?
No. Pat Boone saw the Beatles during a 1963 tour, tried to talk his record company into having him cover Love Me Do. They said, no way. This band is a one-hit wonder. Come on, Pat, you got other things to do. 1964 comes along, Pat Boone takes a hit on his recording royalties. Pat Boone, who has a degree in business and also is a devout Christian, had a situation where he was sponsoring an artist from Indonesia, a man named Leo Jansen. So Pat gets this brainstorm to have Leo do four individual portraits, called them the Beatle Buddies, printed and sold in Sears Roebuck across the country. And with each sale, there was essentially a sweepstakes ticket. You could enter for the chance to see the Beatles in concert. 30 lucky winners went to a concert in Las Vegas a couple of days before the lads would appear at the Hollywood Bowl, to sit with Pat, his wife Shirley, their four daughters, at the convention center and see the Beatles in concert. And it was all because of the Beatle Buddies. Hmm.
And he made more money off the Beatle Buddies than he did royalties that year. So the Beatles bailed him out.
Yeah.
How long did that go on? I mean, how long did people really think that the Beatles were just going to have, you know, one more hit under their belt and they'd be goners?
It's hard to say. I mean, let's face it. By the time their second album came out, all they called it was the Beatles' second album. I think the idea was that they're done. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So, of course, they defied all expectations. Yeah.
Did Pat Boone have?
And now you're thinking there might be a resurgence. So,
did Pat Boone have any longer lasting relationship with them, or is that just in the beginning?
Actually, they had a very lovely day, the day of the concert. After the concert, the concert, they essentially did two shows that day, an afternoon matinee, if you will, and then an evening performance. Pat and his family went to the matinee. Afterwards, they went backstage and met with the band members, and he describes it in very kind terms. They were complete gentlemen, lovely to his daughters. One girl sat on Ringo's lap. Another girl was in a nice conversation with Paul. They were just, you know, fine, upstanding, you know, teen idols, quite frankly.
He was one of the Grand Marshals?
He was a Grand Marshal at
the 4th of July?
4th of July, yeah.
I remember Eddie Albert was one time. Yeah. Anyway.
So, the famous 4th of July parade in the Palisades.
In the Palisades, yeah.
And the Patriotic Pups, are they still doing it?
They're still doing it. Yeah, I've marched with our pup, as a matter of fact.
So we always bring it back to the Palisades. But before I let you guys go, I can't resist the famous acid trips. Is it really not true that Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is a reference to LSD? Was that like a total shocker when people started saying that?
I mean, I wasn't there, but John Lennon.
Any stories?
John Lennon always claims that it was a picture that his son Julian had done of his friend Lucy at school.
Yeah.
And it was on the refrigerator, and he asked his son, you know, what's that? He's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Crazy. And in all of the finding that you did, the interviews you had, the digging, nothing counter to that ever came up? Really? It's just...
No.
No.
Very cool.
We'll let John be the last word on that.
And what about the... Well, this is out of Beatles in L.A., but the thing about... What was the album where... If you played it backwards, it was supposed to said John is dead.
Paul is dead. Yeah,
Paul is dead.
Turn me on. Supposedly, if you ran it backwards, it said "Turn me on, dead man," and then Paul.
But I think he's alive because I saw him at Dodger Stadium.
I was going to say, yeah.
Well, he was alive then. We haven't checked today. This could be our Howard Cosell moment.
This could be. This
hopefully
could be
not.
Hopefully not. Yes.
Not wishing for that.
So, you guys, what year did your book come out? When did it publish?
A week ago. Yeah,
a week ago.
So it's brand new. And is it at the Amazon in the Palisades yet?
That's a good question. I don't believe it is yet, but it will be there soon. It's available through freezenpress.com and wherever fine books are sold.
Yeah, Amazon.com.
Amazon.com. And Barnes & Noble.
We hope to have it at Amoeba Records.
Yes.
Soon.
Oh, cool.
The Beatles in Los Angeles.
It is really, it promises to be a great book. I suggest everybody pick it up and read it. I think it's going to be riveting, even for people who haven't been Beatles fans their whole lives. I think these are just great stories about a town we all live in and memories we share. So thank you both for joining us today. That was a great conversation, and I'm looking forward to the book.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Me too. It's been fun. Tom's been my neighbor. I met Jeremy this morning, so it's been a fun time. Can I, Miriam, clue people in on who next month's guest is?
You're going to do that?
Well, do you want to do it?
No, I do not want to do it. I'm going to leave it to you.
Next month, we have Eugene Levy.
Honorary mayor of the Palisades podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Honorary mayor.
And a resident of Schitt's Creek.
Yes. Yes. And that'll be interesting to hear about how that show came about and how it developed. So. That'll
yet
be fun.
Another interesting Palisadian. Thank you both for joining us. You have topped the list so far, so maybe Eugene will be something to look forward to.
He'll have something to work his way up to.